We are on our second to last week of our fall pastor's Bible study. Next week will be the last week of our apologetic study and what it is to defend our faith. I'll let you in on a little something. Steve and I were talking, Dr. Loffer and I were talking about what's going on for the spring. And by spring, we mean January. But for the first of the year, we're going to be getting into a sermon series out of the book of Revelation. And then, so for our pastor's Bible study, for January through May, with our various breaks in there, we are going to do an extended study of the book of Revelation. So that will include generous discussions on how to suggestively interpret the book or understand it, and getting into all the fun that goes into the text. So sort of tease you a little bit with that, let folks know about it, what's going on and everything. It's going to be a lot of fun. Starting in January. We'll have one more week of, I believe we have one more week of this study, and then we are going to wrap it up after the 7th. And then we will pick things back up on January 11th. So I'll let you know about that. But tonight we're going to be talking and sort of bringing our discussion of apologetics to a close as we get into this topic and discussion about the nature of heaven and how we can understand it, defend it, and talk to folks about it. So let me open us in prayer, and then we'll get underway. So, Father, thank you. You've given us tonight. You've given us an opportunity to be together, that we can be in your place among your people. We're thankful for that. Thank you for the gift of being able to talk about these important things, these things that you have set before us. And we would ask that you would just continue to be at this time, and you would continue to bless us as a community of faith. We ask this in your precious name. Amen. So not to get too far into things, I'll tell you about two people. Got my in-laws are here. So Stephen L. Proctor back there and DJ Proctor, they're back in there. And it's good to have them here. And then my wife is walking in too. She's kind of an in-law. So what happens when you walk in a couple minutes late. But you didn't take a handout either. So, oh, you got a handout. All right. So that's my wife, Kat, in case you haven't met her yet. But as we'll get into it. So we've been discussing, I'll let you sort of know what's been going on. I know that we had last week off, and the week before, I believe, what was the topic the week before? The problem of evil? Yeah, problem of evil and all that stuff, and the fun stuff. This week we're talking about heaven. Next week we'll be talking about the afterlife and what comes beyond this life. Two are sort of interrelated, but we wanted to sort of separate them. They are separate in the discussion that goes on in Kreft and Tesselli's text. We are in, if you want to make sure you're caught up and all that, we are in chapters 11 and 12 of the handbook of Christian apologetics, this thing right here. The chapter 11 is on heaven, chapter 12 is on the other place. We won't get so much into the other place tonight, but we do want to talk a little bit about heaven. And just as a sort of a teaser as well, I guess I'm full of commercials, that in December, our primetimer December Bible study, which will be led by Dr. Bruce Peterson, will be on heaven and having that conversation. So there you go. We're going to approach this a little bit more apologetically and what's going on there. Our study here has been focused on how can we properly articulate and defend the faith, particularly as we're dealing with people that we come into contact with. And this is what we're looking at today. So you'll see at the top of the handout that we have, and I try to use a generous font for a lot of different reasons, so I don't have to talk as much. So we're talking about heaven. What is heaven? So when you talk about it, when people ask you what is heaven, or you're talking about heaven, what is it? How would you describe heaven? I'm sorry? Won't know until we get there? Okay. Ice cream with whipped cream? Okay. Okay. And that's a lot of that's because the nature of the two trees. If you go to the first book, or if you go to the first book of the Bible, Genesis, really Genesis 2, but from Genesis 1 and then you go to Revelation 22, the tree of life occupies both places. So the new heaven is often described as the second Eden, and particularly in Jewish literature. That would make sense with that. So the new Eden. What else? When you talk about heaven, what do you hear? I had someone once describe Midland, Texas to me as heaven. And I said, I didn't know God liked desolate and flat. So I thought that was the other place. But, okay, you the descriptions in the New Testament, streets of gold. Yeah? What else? Somebody asks you about heaven. What do they say? How do you reply to them? Okay, we look up for heaven. We look down for the other place. What else? Okay, it's better than anything that we can imagine. All right, yeah, and yes. There's a personal thought of it on this side of eternity. It's eternity with God is what we heard over here, yeah. What's that? Well, essentially. Yeah, without the threat of a lockout. I mean, again, personal, yeah. And the Yankees lose every night. So, yes.
I think of God's throne and angels.
Okay. And there is in the descriptions that are used of the throne and the angels, the things that go on in there. Yeah, there's it's interesting. The concept of a positive side of the afterlife is something that has been a part of religion or religious experience from the earliest days that we can trace. Now, whether it is in the Israelite faith that we find in the Old Testament, or even the things that are around that time, things that we found from there's an ancient monument that we found called the Enuma Elish, and that's been it proposes on this large obelisk a sort of a secondary creation account that came from pagan mythology. There's always this contrast with the life here in this world versus the life that is beyond. We find that in religious experience that people have had, there's always the conception that there is something beyond this life. And that there's something that we're to aim for, there's something that we're to hope for, there's something that we're to look forward to. So heaven becomes a very important topic. If you're talking to a Muslim, they won't call it heaven, they'll call it what? They'll call it paradise, is the word that they use. Different religions will articulate it differently. I'm sorry? The Garden of Eden. It is God-given. It's a good question. I don't have enough information to completely articulate what the Muslim view is of the afterlife. Something we can certainly probably consider and look up. But that would be you can ask that question next week when Steve is teaching. And I will have him look something up for you. He is our resident Muslim specialist. But I don't have enough data on that. There are differing reports depending upon what segment of Islam you're a part of. One of the reports that goes in, and this actually goes back to the days of the Crusades, was that if you died in a crusade, you would go to paradise, you would go into the afterlife, and be greeted, if you were a guy, very positively, with ample amounts of women that would be available to your delight. Mormonism actually holds to a similar view of this, and we won't get into that too much. Mormonism posits that when you, as a male, die, if you've been a really good Mormon, you will end this world, you will leave this world, and you will go into the next, and you will inherit your own planet that will be, again, populated with many women that will be there for your disposal, That's why when a couple in Mormonism is married in the local temple, which the local temple for Houston is what? Is where? It's in Champion Forest. Yeah, it's in Cypress Champion Forest. Yeah, it's a beautiful place. I grew up around D.C., so we had the D.C. Cathedral, which is amazing. You come around, was it 495, and everybody would stop. It's sort of a natural bottleneck. That's why they put the temple there. But they had on top, they had the trumpet and all that kind of thing. But if you got married in the temple, one of the things that happens, you'll talk to Mormons about this, and it's usually the ones that haven't really kept with the church faith. I was at a conference while I was in seminary, and I ran into a guy, and he identified himself as a Christian. And this was interesting because we all had denominational identities. I was a Baptist. Another guy was Catholic. Another guy was Episcopalian. And this guy just said he was a Christian. So we were all like, that's interesting. And it ended up, he said, he admitted, sort of, we were talking. He's like, yeah, I'm sort of a lapsed Mormon, which was really interesting because we got to talk to him. And what they do is when you get married, they give your wife a password. When she passes away, when she dies, she goes into the afterlife, and as she goes into the afterlife, she's supposed to remember this password so that she can get to the correct planet. So again, these are all discussions of heaven. Now we can talk a little bit. I'll prompt Steve a little bit, and I'll have him talk about different views of the afterlife. That'll be kind of fun for you guys next week. And we can talk a little bit more about some specific things. This idea of heaven has always been a part of that, and I see that hand. Yes. Okay. It very well could be. Again, I'm not as well versed on all that, so I wouldn't. Well, if you've ever been to Turks and Caicos, there is an idea within religious thought that you see develop, particularly in the medieval period, of sort of a waiting place. And that happens within Catholicism with the concept of purgatory. You have your venial sins, you have your mortal sins. You'll be in purgatory until they get expiated or until one of your relatives gives enough money to the church. And then we had the situation that arose 500 years ago. But anyways, so this idea of heaven, and it's very powerful. Think about the nature of it. This is the idea that you are guaranteed a place of safety and security, of joy and fulfillment, of eternal life. So heaven is a very important concept, and it has been a part of almost every major religious tradition. If you go back, particularly within monotheism, the three great monotheistic faiths are Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. But even if you go outside of those into polytheistic, sort of the Hinduism or Buddhism, or you get into Confucianism in the Eastern sect over there, or Zoroastrianism, there is this idea that there has to be something that we're heading for. There has to be something that we're a part of in this world, in this life. So that's always been with the idea of heaven. So we want to talk about that, and we want to talk about it particularly from a Christian angle because the Christian view of heaven is unique. It is an extension of the Jewish and even the Old Testament Israelite theology of heaven. But it is a fulfillment of it in a different way. So we'll pick up sort of with our first major bolded thing. What is heaven? Heaven is described biblically in several ways. It refers to the sky and the atmosphere, what we might consider the stratosphere, and that which is beyond the land. There is this idea that the heaven or heavens are those things above us. Because again, back in the biblical days, it was amazing that you could ascend into the heavens. And we weren't really able to do that till about 110 years ago, at any rate. That's when the Wright brothers there in North Carolina first put their plane into the sky. And now we're in the heavens all the time. It's pretty amazing. We're up into 30,000 feet. And if you're really brave, you can do what Kat and I did a couple years ago and go up to 13,000 feet and jump out of a perfectly good airplane and come back down from the heavens with a parachute attached, of course. You can do it without a parachute. You just only get one shot at it. Usually, unless you bounce. But Anyways, but this idea of the heavens, one, the first thing that you read about, and you have to make the differentiation, you have to make the separation in the scripture text when you're talking about it, because in 2 Corinthians 12, 1 and 2, Paul talks about there being three heavens. Well, what does he mean by that? Well, he's talking about this idea that there's a first heaven, and then there's a second heaven, and then beyond that is a third heaven. So ancient speculation, he's just describing what is natural in the first century. We know we have the stratosphere, all the stuff that's between us and the atmosphere. And then beyond the atmosphere, they knew there was something else out there, what we would call space, the final frontier, if you will, for some of our people. But is that nature outside of where we are? But then the third heaven is what he begins talking about, this person himself, perhaps, who was captured and taken away. This is the heaven that we're really interested in, this third heaven that Paul talks about there in 2 Corinthians 12, 1 and 2. But then he talks about the word is also used to describe a final place for people after death. And this is what we want to focus on. We want to focus on this final place for us. So why is heaven important? Why is heaven important? Because it is important for us to talk about, because it's something that we need to be ready to defend. Now, in my apologetic engagements with people, it's funny, this isn't a question that comes up often, but it does linger. Most issues when I run into them are people wanting to go directly at something physical. They want to go at something that's substantive. They want to go after the Bible. They want to go after the person of Jesus Christ. They want to go after the nature of God. They want to go after the big questions. But this is a really tenuous question that we have to engage with, because it gives us an opportunity to talk about and to talk realistically with people about what happens. They're in the biz, in the ministry biz, you get around a bunch of preachers and they'll start talking about different kinds of sermons and all that stuff. One of the things that guys and ladies that are involved in ministry will always tell you is that you want to make sure you always have a good sermon about heaven for funerals, because it's the one or two moments in people's lives where they begin thinking about that time after this life. We get so busy with the tyranny of the urgent, or we get so busy with the limited nature of who we are, a lot of times we don't ask those next questions because it's not necessarily something we want to think about. But it is something that's out there. So why is heaven important? Now, this comes from actually our textbook from Kreft and Tisselli, and it says, they said this there at the beginning of chapter 11. Next to the idea of God, the idea of heaven is the greatest idea that has ever occurred to the human mind. If it is denied and attacked more today than in the past, then the apologist had better explain and defend it better today than in the past, and certainly not water it down or ignore it. Now, this is really good advice. If we're going to be engaging in apologetics, we want to engage in the defense of our faith completely. We want to be able to engage with what's going on with that. And they point out that people can come after this. Now, why is it hard to argue for the existence of heaven? Why is it hard to argue for the existence of heaven? Most people that go there never come back. That's true. What else? We can't see it. It's hard. We're really empirical people. We're material people. We like seeing the stuff that we can get our hands in and sort of roll up our sleeves and get in the middle of. What else? Why is it hard to argue for heaven? And this is a really critical point. Between heaven and hell, there's not a lot of definition given in the Bible. Most of what we believe about hell doesn't come, or at least not most, but the most popular belief, I should say, about hell doesn't come from the Bible. It comes from what? Dante's Inferno, which was based on a medieval, medieval legends, things that had arisen. If you want some really good, depiction of this, if you go watch the movie Luther, which is a movie about Martin Luther. Ralph Fiennes plays Luther. I think he plays him wrong, because I always figured Luther would be shorter, fatter, and a whole lot jollier, and more cunning. But Ralph does a good job of getting into the character, but there's a scene in there where they have a play going on in front of people, and they talk about the nature of heaven in this scene, and it's a medieval, sort of mid-Renaissance, late medieval scene. And it's about this idea that when you die and you go to hell, there'll be fire and flames and bats will gnaw at you and demons will come up. And the whole idea was putting people into a place of absolute abject fear of this place called hell. and then offering them the grace of heaven so long as you came to it through the church. So it becomes this really significant portion. So it's hard to defend the nature of heaven. One, because we can't see it. Another, because the people that go there don't generally come back and talk about it. I would suggest we do have eyewitness testimony from Paul about it. And every now and then, this is actually something that we have to talk about, something we have to deal with. We get guys or we get people that'll come along and say that they went to heaven and came back. And they'll have movies made about them. Like the movie from 2009 called The Boy Who Went to Heaven. And then the boy comes in 2011 and recants his story after they made a movie about it. So we have to deal with these issues. We have to deal with those things that are going on with it. Because it's a challenging thing. It is that great place, that great beyond. So as we continue on there, after the Crefton Tiselli quote, heaven is important because it is a part, it is our part of the great hope of salvation. While we are in part saved for the here and now, we are also encouraged to look towards our final peace and the full presence of God. It is an aspect of our salvation. When we think about salvation, it's interesting. If you go on TBN, which I know is definitely on your guys' favorites, every now and then on Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening, they put up old Billy Graham crusades. You can go watch Billy from the late 60s to 70s to 80s, and you can always tell by the width of his lapels what decade he's in. For the suit that he was wearing, but he'll do his whole sermon at one of those crusades that he was doing, and he talks vibrantly about heaven. We don't get into those conversations a lot. We don't immediately move to this idea of an afterlife in most of our evangelistic discussions, but the model back in the 70s and the 80s, based largely on evangelism explosion, or if you're a Southern Baptist at the time, continuing witness training, that basically took evangelism explosion and put a new cover on it. Basically, you had your two diagnostic questions. What were your two diagnostic questions? Does anybody remember them? If you were to die tonight, that's the critical, that's the linchpin, absolutely. If you were to die tonight, where would you end up? And if God asked you why, what would you say? Those are the two diagnostic questions for evangelism explosion. The immediate orientation is back into an afterlife orientation, talking about heaven. So heaven becomes an extremely important part of that evangelism. Now, we've moved away from some of that, but it is still very important. We do have as a part of our salvation an aspect of being saved for the here and now, that there are things that we're supposed to work out while we're in this life. But we recognize that salvation also has an otherworldly trajectory, that there is something that we have, a great hope that we are looking forward to, that we're supposed to be a part of. This is what heaven is about. Notice this, Hebrews 11:16. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. This is one of the better verses. Because of the nature of the context that's talking about in Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11 occupies a pivot point in the book of Hebrews where the author is talking about the nature of salvation history, leaving sort of where these people have been dealing with and moving into a conversation about these great heroes of the faith. Now, in verse 12, we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. Let us therefore press on, is what the author keeps going with. So when heaven is in question, it is easy to question the nature of God and the purpose of Christ coming into this world. So heaven is a key concept for a complete understanding of the Christian faith. So we want to get into it. Now we recognize a couple things as we do, that we have an aspect of a limited nature of how we're going to be able to access this. Our primary way that we know and that we want to discuss the nature of heaven comes from what we know in our revelation, the Bible. But there are some other things that we want to get into. So as we get into it, what are some of the objections about heaven? Or what are some of the objections to heaven? So one is atheistic materialism. Atheistic materialism. And this is the idea that because there is no God, there is no image of God or a soul. Therefore, we are only organisms. And when our bodies die, all of us dies and stays dead forever. Now, this, some of this comes out of directly out of Crefton Tiselli, because they're going to go through these different parts. This idea is, now, this would be called, we could call this humanistic materialism. We could call this atheistic materialism. This idea that materialists are people that believe that the only things that exist are those things which can be observed, measured, and weighed. And this is something that in the first couple weeks we talked about. It is a challenge because we live in a very, and the technical term is a very empiricist age. We live in an age of empiricism. We live in an age of scientism. All that stuff that can be measured, can be weighed, can be checked objectively and checked again. That is what is real. That is what is true. But we've already offered several objections to that view, that there are things that are in this world that cannot be measured, that cannot be weighed, that we know exist. And probably the easiest thing that we can point to is the idea of consciousness. Why are human beings so unique from all the other animals? We're the only ones that can create with organizational structure. We're the only ones that choose to create things like art and aesthetic materials. But we know this comes from a consciousness that we have, that we're aware of it. Now, that's a question that most atheistic materialists can't, or atheist materialists can't really readily answer. Why do we have consciousness? We can't weigh our consciousness. We don't know where it exists, but we know we're all conscious beings. They would suggest that because there is no God, because we can't check, we can't evidence, we can't find God, therefore there is no image of God in humanity, therefore there is no reason for heaven to exist. That's a pretty general objection that you'll get as well. So now the second one, and this is sort of a theistic view or a deistic view, God exists but no life after death. It is unusual but possible to believe this. Such a God either does not love us enough to save us from final death or lacks the power to do it. The idea here is that there is a God. Again, this is that distanced God from humanity, the God of deism, this apathetic God, this agnostic God, the God that's out there that it wants to create, wants to be a part of this, but then immediately disengages himself or itself from the world. And then when we die, we simply go poof. These first two are when we die, we just cease to exist. We go into nothingness. And with this, one movie that came out not long ago that dealt with a combination of these issues philosophically was the movie Inception. I don't know if you guys ever saw that movie. It was Leonardo DiCaprio was in it, and it was all about dreams. And it was all about secondary reality. It was a really interesting, very complex movie as it structured itself philosophically, but it dealt with this idea, and this was what was really interesting, because it asks a critical question in the midst of the movie. Why is it whenever we, and it's all based around this idea of we're all dreaming and all this kind of thing, why is it when we come into a dream, we come into the midst of it and not at the beginning or not near the end? We don't walk into a dream from its beginning, but rather we find ourselves in the midst of it. What they would point out is that in life, in your consciousness that you find, think about your first memories. You generally, and if you do, I would love to find out who you are. If you remember your birth, that would be really interesting because most people don't remember it. I tell people all the time, yeah, I was born in Massachusetts. I was born around the Boston area for 6 unremarkable months of my life. I don't remember anything about it. Because that's sort of the nature of how we are. But I do remember being in this life and coming into the midst of it. These people, that sort of the materialists, but also these agnostics would point out that this is the way things are. God just puts us into the midst of this reality, and then he takes us out, and just as we came in with no background or history, so we go out with no background or history. We simply cease to exist. Our ceasing to exist, though it might be physically painful, at the end is just a release. Sort of like a relaxing of the muscle, and then we vaporize or we vanish from reality. These are the first two objections that you'll occasionally run into. A third objection is skepticism, and this is that no one can ever know what happens after death. I think that I'm going to show you some data here in a few moments that I think this isn't true. I think skepticism, the skeptic view on this, is very easily refuted. Fourth view is ancient paganism, which is after we die, we become pale, hardly living copies of the living things that we were. We become ghosts. inhabiting a gloomy and dark underworld. You don't run into people like this too often, but if you go to the Texas Renaissance Fair that happens in the month of November, you'll find them all over the place. It's kind of neat. You can go up and talk to them. But this is actually one of the ancient pagan things. When we die, we go under the sea, is like a language that you'll hear from pagan mythology, because the sea was mysterious. So we go down into the depths of the sea, or we go down into the depths of this world, or we ascend into the glories of the heavens, because we know the heaven is glorious, because what comes from the heaven? The sun, and the sun gives us warmth, it gives us heat, it gives us vibrancy. So again, think about this in the ancient pagan mind. There's some stuff that's going on there. Ancient paganism doesn't really exist too much, but you'll find funny remnants of it here and there. Then also you have the Platonic view, which is the immortality of the soul alone, that when we die, the body dies forever, but then our soul is released, or our spirit lives forever, and that sort of comes out. There's this idea of this. Number six is pantheism. Pantheism is not to be confused with panentheism, and we won't get too far into this, but pantheism is this idea that we are all gods in the world, and is this idea that we are drops in the cosmic ocean, pieces of God's stuff, and at death the drop returns to the sea, and it absorbs your individuality. You just become another drop in the sea, and so forth. This is another view. Then also, and the seventh view, which is a really interesting view, you'll hear about it every now and then, is the view of reincarnation. Who do you remember from your life? Maybe you heard about a celebrity or a politician or a leader or someone that believed in reincarnation. Who believed in reincarnation? Anybody that you can remember? I got a couple. What do we have over here? Shirley MacLaine? Yeah? Who else? Okay. A relative? Can definitely happen. A George Patton? General from World War II. I like watching the movie Patton, just because it's a good movie. And in the sort of in the middle, he takes his crew, his lieutenants and all that stuff, off to a battlefield. And he said he was a Carthaginian, and he fought on that battlefield several thousand years. He actually, George Patton himself, and this wasn't just George C. Scott, but this was actual George Patton, believed that he was a reincarnated Carthaginian. Private in their army. So, and that's just sort of the way that it goes. You'll hear about this view every now and then, but you primarily find views of reincarnation in Eastern religions, and there's a lot of reasons for that. But it's this, that after our body dies, our soul gets another earthly or mortal body, and the soul is to the body like a traveling salesman to a motel room, so that when you're done with it, you just get your stuff and you move along. Now, what are some problems with reincarnation? Because you're not going to really run into it. Now, I will say this. In Houston, you're going to run into people that believe in reincarnation more commonly than in some other places in the world. Why? Because we have a lot of people from Asia that move to this area. And particularly when you look at the demographic shift that's going on here in Clear Lake, the University of Houston Clear Lake has a lot of students that come here from India. And the predominant view religiously in India is one of Hinduism or Buddhism. And they believe in aspects of reincarnation. It also goes with the idea of achieving nirvana. Now, reincarnation, basically, the Eastern view basically states that you go through this life, and if you do good, and you do very good, you are in your next life elevated to another state. But if you do bad, you go to something much less than yourself. You become something that's unclean, or you become something that's unworthy, and then you have to begin your process altogether. But when you do enough good, that at some point by doing enough good, you will reach nirvana, which isn't a band from the 90s, but rather it's this idea that you'll reach existential satisfaction, or that you'll disappear into the cosmos and be assumed into the ultimate reality. A lot of fun concepts dealing with there, with that right there. A lot of this is based on reincarnation. There's just some basic objections that I include to reincarnation. I think the bigger question for reincarnation is, who is the being or the force or the substance that determines what is good versus what is bad? And what being or force or substance directs our path for reincarnation? Because Eastern religions will tell you there is no supreme being or supreme substance or supreme oneness, that there's not a singularity out there, but rather that it's this larger force. You could run into this a little bit, but anyways, there's some larger things. So how do we develop a heavenly apologetic? How do we develop a heavenly apologetic? And this is where we're going to spend the rest of our time. I grabbed a few things from Harold Wilmington's Bible handbook. I worked with Dr. Wilmington while I was at Liberty. He actually taught the pastor's Bible study on Wednesday nights at Thomas Road Baptist Church when I was on staff there. And I got to know Dr. Wilmington. He's a great guy. He has a Bible handbook that's out. It's been out forever. And you can find it on christianbook.com or Amazon. The big version's probably it's nice and thick, and it's got a green cover on it. And he goes through, and he's the list guy. He knew how to create an outline like you wouldn't believe. Harold just knew what he was doing when it came to outlining. And every time he sat down and had a Bible study with him, everything would be outlined. You know, Roman numeral 1, point capital letter A, point capital letter B, 1, micro 1, lowercase a, some weird Roman character you've never seen before. You know, he'd get all to going. I mean, and that's what he would do. That's how he worked his way through books systematically of the Bible. And he was a great, great teacher. So I went and grabbed a couple things from him because he's got some good things about identifying what heaven is. So if we're going to begin by understanding and creating a defense for heaven, one of the first things that we need to do is make sure that we have the right conception of heaven. One of the tough things that Christianity has to deal with is that so too often, and you'll see this occasionally, that people don't articulate the basis of Christianity properly. So for instance, when Richard Dawkins, who is a prominent new atheist, when Richard Dawkins gets together, or when you hear one of these other guys that'll come along and sort of start making claims, they'll start talking about a conception of God, and I'm sitting there listening to them and going, that's great, I don't believe in that conception of God either, because you're improperly defining who God is. So one of the things that I always try to do is make sure when we come to these tough questions that we're on the same page in our definitions. So what do we say about heaven? Well, who will be there? So who will be in heaven? What do you guys think? If I was to ask you, who's going to be in heaven, what would you say? God's going to be in heaven, yes. Good Sunday school answer. We'll include Jesus in there and the presence of the Holy Spirit. We got it. We're good for Sunday. But who else will be there? God's children, okay? The people who pass the final exam. And the final exam being, is your name in the Lamb's Book of Life? Yeah. There's all kinds of jokes, ministerial jokes about this. Will I see people that I love in heaven? Yes. You'll also see those that you don't. That kind of thing. So it's the people, we would say, in Christian terms, those who have been born again. If you want to use an evangelical or a New Testament view, those people who have been born again. Those who have looked faithfully towards Christ before his birth. This is talking about the Old Testament Israelite religion. Those who maintain covenant faithfulness. Yes. Yeah, covenant. Yeah. And one of the things that I think is important about the nature of the narrative in Scripture, and this is because it comes up, because people are going to ask you about this. They're going to say, well, what about all those people that lived in the first 2/3 of the book? Because you pick up the Bible, and let's just be honest, it's a little weighted towards the First Testament or the Old Testament. It used to be called the First Testament, but we call it the Old Testament, because it's about 2/3 of the Bible are in there, and about another 1/3 is the New Testament. One of the things that we began walking through, we began sort of touching on it earlier in August, was this idea of the covenant relationship. And I want to touch on this because it's a helpful apologetic. I would suggest that the covenant relationship that we have with God begins in Eden and goes all the way to the second Eden. And that between all of it, it is this idea of a covenant of faithfulness. A covenant of faithfulness on our behalf with God and God with us. And I want to be careful about how we articulate this, because the nature of the covenants in the Old Testament were that God built upon this idea of people, and it was an ever-expanding covenant. The first covenant really begins, if you want to get into it, with Noah and his family, however we understand that story, after the flood had occurred, and he gives them the sign of the covenant, which is a rainbow. Yeah, the rainbow in the sky. It's a reminder of the covenant. And that was a very few number of people. And then we have an ever-expanding covenant to the family of Abraham. Now, I'm not going to bog this down too much, but the idea is that idea of covenant, of faithfulness, carries through to the new covenant, which is established in Jeremiah, fulfilled at the cross, and completed, as it's completely talked about throughout the New Testament, particularly in the book of Hebrews. The new covenant is the focus of the book of Hebrews. So those people who are participants in the covenant identity of the faithfulness of God are in heaven, is who we would say. But it's all this. There's also another group that are in heaven. We wouldn't call them people because they're angels. They're heavenly beings, if you will. They're seraphim. They are this idea that there are beings that are in heaven that we will encounter, that we'll know about. And we know that they're there. So that's who populates heaven. And the primary group, primary book that we get that we'll see about it is really in Revelation 21 and 22 is where you begin getting the physical descriptions of heaven, however we understand that. But this, again, talks about the heavenly host or the heavenly body or the population of heaven. So what will they experience? Well, Harold gives us a pretty good list here: holiness, beauty, unity, perfection, joy, no tears, no sickness or pain, no death, no second death, no third death, no thirst or hunger, no sin or judgment, no need for sun or moon, no night. And he goes through and he does a good job of laying out some great passages that you can go look at this. And how long will heaven last? Well, we would say forever. I would say this, and this is where I would make a slight amendment. I would say that heaven is an everlasting institution for the eternal God. That heaven is an everlasting institution for the eternal God. Heaven is still a created place. God is an uncreated being. So that we want to make sure that we understand that, that there is, this is not something that's always existed. Only God has always existed. So heaven is, and this is sort of the end of that page, a place for those who are part of the redeemed people of God in the Old Testament, those in the covenant bond of Israel. Then this is, you'll see about this in Isaiah 53. And in the new covenant, those who are redeemed by the atonement of Jesus Christ. The place that exists presently, but will also be established at the end of the age. This is a place where heavenly beings reside, where God is immediately present. And it often has earthly terms used to describe it, yet it transcends physical description, and it is a place beyond this life. Now, these are good scriptural places to go to talk about heaven, because Christianity talks about heaven in very complete and concrete terms when we deal with certain aspects of it. Now, I want to give you a second evidence for heaven beyond scripture, because you're going to run into people that are going to say, hey, I think that's great. I don't buy what's in the scriptures. I don't buy the New Testament. If you show me something from the New Testament, I'm not going to believe it. So what's another place that we can go to talk about the nature of heaven? Because we generally know that people that go to heaven don't come back, and that we also know that it's a place that is just the greater beyond. It's that thing, that step beyond us that we can't ever come to. It is that thing that we believe is out there, but we don't have a lot of data for. I'm going to suggest there's one group of experiences that help us better understand the reality of heaven and help us argue for it. Now, Steve might get a little bit more into this next week, so I don't want to steal all of his thunder, but I do want to use them because I think they're important, and they're called near-death experiences. So if you flip over to the back page, the final page, this is where we're going to talk about this. What's a near-death experience? And it's not driving on Beltway 8 at rush hour. So it's not that. What's a near-death experience? Yes. Yes. And what do their descriptions sound like? Yeah. And this is interesting because you say you've had people that, patients of yours, that said that they have had those experiences. And what's interesting is we know that these experiences exist. Now, there are some people that would tell you that this is a kind of psychosomatic event of the emptying of certain glands in your brain as you prepare for, as the sort of the body prepares itself for death. The challenge is the experiences are varied enough, but very similar, that it just seems to defy scientific explanation just as glands emptying themselves. A near-death experience is exactly what you've been describing. Someone that for a time was clinically dead or passed from this present life, beginning the process of going into this next life. Probably one of the more significant ones locally that we know about, the guy that wrote 90 Minutes in Heaven. I always forget his name. It's Don Piper. It's not John Piper. I always get him, and for some reason I get Don and John mixed up. They're not related at all. But yeah, it's Don Piper. You're absolutely right. Now, Don's book talks more about his rehabilitation and all that thing, but what had happened to Don, he was up near Huntsville, Texas, I believe. I think that's where it occurred. And he was going to go see somebody on a trip, and a prison bus was coming, he was going down the highway, and the bus driver just decided to try to get around a semi that was on a double lane, and he ran into Don, and Don died on impact. They got there, the EMS got there, they pulled him out of the car, and they laid him on the side of the highway, and he put a sheet over him because he was dead. Because they looked at him and they checked for pulses, and he was dead. And for 90 minutes he laid on the side of the highway while they were doing all the other work, and then he began to resuscitate. He's one example of somebody with a near-death experience. And there are a lot of them, though. What's interesting about near-death experiences is this is a very unique, growing field of literature in scientific and medical studies. There's actually a peer-reviewed scientific journal that's printed out of the University of Virginia. You'll see it at the bottom of the page, the Journal of Near-Death Studies. One of my doctoral mentors, Gary Habermas, who's an apologist out of Liberty University, has been documenting near-death experiences for 2 decades. He has all kinds of discussions about them. I believe near-death experiences are a way to talk about that, one, there is an afterlife, but two, that afterlife involves heaven or some kind of other place for a number of reasons. And this is where we move from the biblical apologetic into an evidential apologetic. Because as best we know, there are tens of thousands of near-death experiences that are recorded and that are transcribed and have been talked about in recent decades. And they can be varied. A couple things about them. Often, this is the first bullet point that you'll see. Often they claim to have had similar experiences using language of a dark tunnel, a light at the end of the tunnel, some kind of existential event where they encounter a touch of the afterlife. Most of them, by and large, are positive. You are surrounded by the warmth, a warmth that's there, regardless of how it's happened. Particularly, it seems if someone has had a particularly violent death or something that has happened physically that's been very injurious, that they're surrounded by warmth. They feel like they're clothed as they're in this disembodied state moving along this terrestrial plane. You'll hear about things from people that will recognize. My grandmother, actually, she ended up having a brain cancer when I was in seminary, and she passed away. When I was in college, and she passed away. And she told my grandfather, who was a Baptist minister, in Oklahoma, that before she died, she went to a place where she had to be resuscitated in the hospital, and that she had gone and she had seen what was on the other side. And her words were, "I saw our son," not my dad, but he had a brother that was stillborn before him, that he was of a certain age, and he saw her, and she saw several other relatives that were there before her. There is this, and there is a continual description of people that they get into this near-death experience. They run into people. They run into other animals, maybe that they are animals that they've had, like pets or something like that. I don't know if all dogs go to heaven. None of them describe cats being there, but it's possible. But the idea that they get into is this idea, there's something that goes on with it. But there is, this is a second bullet point, there is enough data available through thousands of stories and specific documentable awarenesses documentable awareness and other things such as that to suggest that there is something beyond this life. Again, near-death experiences. And what happens with these near-death experiences is there's stuff that goes on that you can't explain. There's stuff that happens. Like one of the ones that Dr. Habermas will talk about is you'll hear about people that will, and these are fairly documented, they're in a hospital room and they suddenly start, they pass away, they pass away. And they go and they float above the bed and they're looking down at all the attendants around them or their family. They'll go out into the hallway and they'll hear about a conversation that's occurring that they should have no access to. One of the ones that he refers to pretty significantly is someone that she passed away and she said she felt her body floating up through the hospital and that suddenly she found herself looking down on the hospital. And she said, there's a red shoe on the hospital ceiling or on the hospital roof. And I mean, nobody ever goes to the hospital roof. This doesn't have a landing pad or anything like that. So they went upstairs, and guess what they found? A red shoe next to the air conditioner. So again, these are near-death experiences where people have strange situations. Another part of them are, near-death appearances. A mother or a grandmother or a grandfather or a father are in the hospital but then appear to their families in their home or at their church or appear to someone that there's a place that they shouldn't be and that they find out that only moments before they had passed away. So there's something going on. It's not an apparition, so to speak. So we know there's something that happens. With these, I would suggest to you that near-death experiences are a good way to argue for the existence of something beyond this world, but also the existence of heaven. And we have a lot of these that are documented. Most of them, as you'll all notice, they're generally fairly positive. Now, what gets concerning about this, and they're not necessarily concerning, it may be the wrong word, but what's compelling about this is that people from varying religions, people from varying places in the globe, people from varying points of history from different places around the world have similar events that are distinct enough to describe what's going on. I've got a whole thing. There's actually an article on The Atlantic, which is a publication about near-death experiences that came out a couple years ago. Probably one that might strike you as interesting. This is from a discussion of from the book Beyond the Light by P.M.H. Atwater that was published in 1994 that talks about several near-death experiences. Someone who lived in Texas City had a near-death episode which took place in a hospital when she was very young, and she talks about this idea that there was something going on, that there was a figure standing in the light that was shaped like a normal human being with no distinct facial features, but it had a masculine presence. And they told him things, or told her things about her life that would happen. She recognized that this was, she begins talking to her parents about this, and that there was a figure in the room and began telling her things that she couldn't have known at that point. There's a number of others that occur. Ernest Hemingway is one of the people that is suggested to have had a near-death experience when he was a soldier in World War I. He was down on the banks of a river near in Italy, near Milan. And what ended up happening, he was fighting in one of the trenches, and a mortar bomb went off and almost killed him. And he described the experience in a number of points and a couple of his books that he talks about. A Farewell to Arms is one of the ones. And he talks about what you would come into, how you tried to breathe, but the breath would not come, and that he, as a presence, went swiftly out of the body, and he knew he was dead, and he floated up above himself in the realm, but then he comes back down, and he reassumes that body, that place where he is. The reality of near-death experiences, as diverse as they are, provide us a provocative investigation as to the nature of what heaven could be. I would suggest to you this, that because we have scriptural data, we have the evidence of archaeology, we also have the reality of where heaven is, that when we combine them with near-death experience literature and experience, that we encounter some things that allow us to argue positively for the reality of heaven. And I think this is something that helps increase our understanding apologetically and helps us defend our faith. Because ultimately this is where we end up. That if there is a God who exists, who we believe is God, and if that God created humanity in such a way that he put his image within us, that sin broke that image or corrupted that image in some way, that Jesus Christ came and through his life and his death and then his resurrection, he atones for that, it allows us to enjoy a new relationship with God and to have a relationship in this world, but also a hope for the next world where we will be restored, where we will be redeemed, and where we will not experience another death. The other option doesn't provide that for us. Heaven is a great hope for us, and it's a great way that I believe that we can argue positively for the existence of God as we argue positively for the existence of heaven. And that's sort of where we got to tonight with it. Next week, we'll talk a little bit about stuff from the afterlife, and then we're going to be wrapped up. So thank you much. If anybody, I got a couple minutes if anybody has any questions. Yes. In terms of near-death experience? Yeah, it's sort of the, and this is what becomes a bit perplexing, because when we talk to people, whether they are highly educated, so we want to do the class system right here, that we have people that are highly educated, we would consider objective cultural people, say somebody from the United States, for instance, who grew up in Texas and Houston, was educated, versus a third world person who is not educated, is illiterate, has a different religion, they have this similar entryway into near-death experience. Now, what happens after that? Usually what ends up happening with most near-death experiences is they terminate at one point. Most people describe getting up to the wall. And the best descriptor that they can use is that there's a sheer wall of light in front of you. And you reach out, but you can never touch it. But you're floating there. It's almost like the way that they describe it is if an astronaut was up in space, and they were in there doing their spacewalk, and they put their hands out to try to touch the side of the space shuttle, but they were this far from the space shuttle, they could never reach forward and touch it because they couldn't get that kind of, they didn't have a pack on them or something, they can't get inertia to do that. It's in a similar way that you're floating there in front of this giant wall of light, and then it goes away. So the question for a lot of it is, what happens beyond that wall of light? But too many of them do all come to that similar place. The challenge is that seems to be the terminus, that once we go over it, you can't come back. That's not completely concrete. It's a lot of this is interesting conversations, but that's kind of it. Yeah. Yes. Yes, this is the good second question. What about negative experiences? And they do exist. There are people who recount having a negative experience in their near-death experience. Torment, anguish, feeling that they're being clutched, they're being bound over. Probably one of the most significant ones that I've heard of is there is a man named Paul Tillich. Paul Tillich was a theologian in the early to mid 1900s, we call it last century, and he was a German theologian. Paul was an existentialist theologian. He was very, very to the left. He did not posit that Jesus was necessarily divine, but that he was he was an aspect of the divine. And he has this idea of the being and all this stuff. Anyways, Paul had a difficult life. He had multiple affairs with secretaries. And when Bonhoeffer and him chose to either stay in Germany or leave Germany to to be faithful to the church or to leave the church. Paul left the church. He had a very difficult life. At the end of his life, one day he was teaching class. And this is the way the story goes. He was teaching class and he began having a heart attack. And they rushed him to the hospital. He was teaching at Harvard. They rushed him to the hospital there. And one of his friends that was with him, described the scene of him being in severe existential torment, screaming about how hot it was, screaming about what he was being held over with, about the chains that were around him. A man who was a theologian with substantial education behind him, having a deeply negative experience, is something that is compelling in the literature. So yes, there is the negative experience. They aren't, I will say this, they aren't as many as the positive that we know of. The reasoning that goes in with that is that because most people that experience the negative side can't come back. But that is a good question. So there is a negative side to it. So, yes. And it depends on the... Now, I'm sorry, Tillich didn't come back. He died on the operating table. There are discussions and there are people out there that will tell you, and you'll hear this, and particularly in evangelist literature and all that stuff, and you'll hear about it, some other people that will have had the negative experience and that changed their life. They come back and they're changed. But again, the data isn't as rich as the other part in terms of where it is. So yeah, that's good. Yes. Yeah, she went to the witch at Endor in Samuel, 1 Samuel 15. Yeah, that's a difficult passage. Yeah. Well, of course not. I mean, what? So the question is about the witch at Endor and the apparition of Samuel, and I'm not going to be able to give you a good answer on that. I have read that. I've done the exegesis. I've done what's funny is I've looked at almost every major commentary, including technical commentaries for the last 100 years, and every one of them, when they come to that passage, they punt. They do not answer the question. I think that there's a lot of Israelite imagery that's wrapped into that. The nature of the reappearance of Samuel is difficult. He is in a disembodied state, but he's clearly present in the text. So where now, and we have to be careful about the directional language that's used, because that the difficulty with the word Sheol is that it's also used to describe Jonah's transition into the whale. There's some language that's in there that's probably being used, I wouldn't say messianically, but it is language of descent. Because he descends and he descends and he descends, and then he comes up and he comes up and he comes up. The challenge with Sheol is that the language is so unspecific about the nature of death. And we want to be careful about using modern Hebrew concepts to understand that century's Hebrew concepts. Because, and I'm not a Hebrew expert on this, the challenge with it is almost everybody goes to Sheol in the Old Testament when it talks about them. What's that? Of the purgatory. Yes. No. And that's exactly right. That this space of purgatory is that middle ground. That's where Samuel went to. I can give you the freaky explanation that the witch at Endor was able to command Samuel to come out from heaven, which causes all kinds of theological problems. But I just don't know. I read that text several times. Yeah, it's a fun text to talk to people about. I usually try to preach it around October 31st. Because I've got a whole thing on zombies in the Bible, about what happens after Jesus dies, and then Revelation and all that. But Yeah, that's a funky text. And, yeah, we'll keep it for Steve. Well, you should ask him about that next week. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, one last question.
No question.
Okay. Yes. John Burke's Consider Heaven, yes. Yes, Mary Lou's son-in-law, and he's actually come and spoken here a couple months ago. John Burke's, it's a good book. Yes. Absolutely, there's a good text for that, yes. Well, that's all I got. Thank you, and we'll see you next week. And if any of you have insights on the Witch at Endor and the disembodied Samuel, I will welcome them happily.